morning. We're delighted to welcome you all here. We have some special guests. We have Sussex Hamilton High School students. Will they please stand? Delighted to have you with us. The students are here with a national award-winning program. You may be seated. This national award-winning program is sponsored by the Supreme Court and by the State Bar of Wisconsin. We invite students from across the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, the students get material about the case, listen to an oral argument here in the courtroom, and then meet with a justice assigned for the day to meet the students. The subject of the discussion is the procedure of the court in taking a case, hearing the case, deciding the case, not the substantive issues of the case itself. Now that I've introduced the students to us, let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensay. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her right is Justice David Prosser. And Justice Prosser is the justice with whom you'll meet after this case. And on the far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. With all of those introductions made, I should ask, is there anyone here who would like a summary of the case we're about to hear? Knowing something about the facts and the legal issues helps you listen to oral argument. All right. Yes, not. Ms. Nodal. Let me call the second case today, 2012-2466, Suzanne Stoker versus Milwaukee County. Arguing on behalf of Milwaukee County will be Mr. Levy for 15 minutes, 10 minutes for Attorney Beth Hannon representing the Milwaukee County Pension Board, 30 minutes for Jeffrey P. Sweetland, attorney representing the plaintiff, Shirley T. Carson, and 5 minutes in rebuttal for Mr. Levy. For the students who were not here in the last hour, Mr. Levy and Mr. Sweetland argued a similar case that's before the court. Now they've changed positions at the council table, and Mr. Levy will proceed in, this time he doesn't like the Court of Appeals opinion. Last time he did. And as Justice Crook says, different panel.
May it please the court. In this case, I represent Milwaukee County as the defendant appellant petitioner in an action regarding the use of a multiplier in its pension system. In the proceedings below, there was an oral opinion followed by the circuit court, which found that the multiplier formula itself vested and could not be changed. Not talking about benefits received or eligibility for benefits, but the very formula. The court there said that Loaf was at odds with Welter and Rarehour, but then went on to decide that the Court of Appeals decisions in those two matters were more applicable than this court's Supreme Court decision in Loaf. The Court of Appeals affirmed, saying they would not follow Loaf because it was a case about health benefits from the city rather than the county, and that makes it inapplicable. In addition, the court below said that Loaf never discussed two cases, Welter and Rarehour, and the reliance on those cases plus 1945 and 1965 public laws made the difference.
Counsel, does your client acknowledge that there is a property interest in the actual retirement benefits that have been accruing during the course of the employee's term of employment?
We think there's a property benefit.
Can you just hold that microphone down? Thank you.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Your Honor. The county believes there is a property interest in the benefits which have been earned. This is not the same as a property interest in a formula for calculating
right.
future benefits.
And that's your distinction. The distinction is there's a property interest in one, but there's not a property interest in how something is calculated or what formula is used to derive the accrual of the time.
Prospective benefits, that's right.
Okay.
And we think that is a crucial difference. The reason why we seek reversal of the lower courts in this case. What happened here is that when Ms. Stoker, the plaintiff, was hired in 1982, the multiplier, and just to make everybody be on the same page, the benefit is years of service times average salary at end of career times this multiplier, which is just a number. I mean, there's nothing attached to a career or anything like that, or a job category. Anyway, when she was hired, the multiplier in 1982 was 1.5%. In 2001, it was changed to 2%. And in 2012, and I might add, this effective date was somewhat later than other county employees because there was a labor contract that had to expire before there could be any change. So when it was changed, finally in 2012, the multiplier went to 1.6% for years in the future. So if you had 20 years on that day, you got 20 times 2%, and if you had 5 more years later, you had 5 years times 1.6%.
And so if the retirement had occurred during the period where the multiplier was 2%, that's what those retirees received the benefit of.
They would get that 2% for all the years when the 2% was in effect. If they retired 5 years after the change, they'd get the 2% multiplier for the first part of their career. And
right. That's a little bit of a different way of saying the same thing. Under my hypothetical, the person had retired. That's it, 2%. Your hypothetical, they keep working. Benefit of 2% for the time period that respective contract was in place. New contract comes in, new multiplier.
Exactly. And we think this is exactly the same kind of scenario that Lightborn was talking about when they used that phrase about the benefit is what was accrued for, and I use the phrase in the case, services rendered or service rendered. Interestingly, that is the same language in the ordinance itself, which talks about for years of service rendered after a given date or for years of service rendered prior to a given date. It's always service rendered. That's what the vesting is about. What do you get paid for the work you performed in the appropriate time period? And these benefits only get vested when they're earned. You don't have that benefit in your hand until you do the work.
Counsel, I'm always leery of cases being cited that deal with, say, different states that might not have our language. Lightborn dealt with the state retirement plan, not our language. I want to take a look at the language that we have before us. The scenario you paint, which is accurate, of what happened, it went, go from multiplier of 2, renegotiation to 1.6, probably lots of rationale. We have only a stipulation of facts to know what was going on, but probably lots of rationale. But it seems to me that even though it sounds like reasonable policy choice, the answer isn't in the reasonableness of the policy choice. The answer lies in the words of the contract, the ordinance, and the statutes. And so is there anything else that you would be pointing to in the words of this contract, statute, ordinance?
I would point to the party stipulation.
Okay.
In petitioner's appendix, page 48, it actually starts the page prior to that.
Okay.
The bottom of prior page is paragraph 9. On or about December 17th, they amended the ordinance. And when you go through the ordinance, it says, and just as an example, five lines down.
Five lines on page 49?
Page 48.
48. 48 or
49?
You really?
48.
Okay.
They're talking about the number of years of service rendered, prior to January 1, 2010. And further down, you'll see the phrasing, again, number of years of service rendered prior to January 10. That idea of service rendered is throughout the calculation. And the underlined portions on this page are the additions. The years of service phrase was there far earlier than this amendment.
So you're pointing us to paragraph 6 of the stipulation?
No, I'm pointing to paragraph 9, which on page 48 of the petitioner's appendix.
Oh, I'm looking at the pension board. Sorry.
I'm sorry.
No, that's my problem. Okay. Got it. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
What does that give you? It sounds to me that then you're going back to the eligibility issue. You're not eligible for a pension until you've had the number of years of service, and you're not eligible until you actually retire or die or something.
This analysis
does
not require actual retirement or death.
All right.
This analysis simply says we have different formulae over the years for calculating the amount of the benefit. And that really is a balancing of what the employee is going to get when they retire and what the board to pay to support the benefit. It's the legislative decision about the appropriate balance of what the taxpayers are going to put into this and what the employee is going to receive from this. It doesn't require a particular moment in time, but simply to say, like retirement, but simply to say that in this situation, we're saying we had to rebalance our priorities and how we spend taxpayer money.
And can they go below the multiplier amount that was originally in this contract, originally in the statute?
I think that is a different argument which has not been attempted.
You don't want to, what's my hypothetical? What's the answer to my hypothetical?
I think that your hypothetical raises the question of whether the person is covered by those 1945 and 65 amendments.
Sure.
And if they're subject to those, then they can't go below what they had when those amendments went into effect or when they commenced their employment.
But they can go below an amendment that increased the benefits. That's your argument.
Yes.
Increase the multiplier.
Yes.
Okay. Now, you sort of have the same issue of the use of the word vested here. In 45, it said, Chapter 138, each member and beneficiary having such a benefit contract shall have a vested right to such annuities and benefits, and they shall not be diminished or impaired. It doesn't say you have a vested right to the formula, but for the ultimate annuity or benefit, and that's the ultimate annuity or benefit is determined by the formula. The higher the formula, the higher the benefit. Then it says in 1965, each county is hereby empowered to make any changes in such benefit fund which hereafter may be necessary or desirable, gives the county Brobel. But, says this, this is chapter 405, laws of 65, but no such change shall operate to diminish or impair the rights of any person who is a member of such benefit fund prior to the effective date of any such change. How do you get around that language?
We have not taken anything that they had as of the date of the change. It's a purely prospective change.
Oh, but before the change, prospectively, their expectation was the higher percent, the 2%. Prospectively, that was what they expected for the benefit fund.
Again, the change is permissible as long as it does not take away what they had when they started. And it certainly doesn't do that. The fact that they may have hoped for more, I suppose, is true of everybody who is working and expecting to be compensated.
I think what I hear you saying, counsel, is the expectation would be not prospective, except in the manner you've just described, reflecting an optimism that most employees have, but presently, the present expectation that would follow the pattern or follow the regulation that has been set forward by the present contract. What happens in the future would therefore be dependent on subsequent contracts. I think that's what I hear you say.
You're absolutely right. That's what I've been trying to express.
Okay.
No, as you explained in the last argument, this can be a large amount of money that the county owes, right?
Yes.
And per year, and then it may extend year after year after year. And that is a debt of the county that the taxpayers pay. But if they agreed to pay that under these statutes, then they may get stuck. But there is, and you said it in the last argument, if the county were bankrupt, or if that's possible, or if the county was in dire financial straits, then I think another rule kicks in that it can then make changes in their plans.
That is another rule, and that is a possibility
right.
In the worst-case scenario.
And you're not relying on that rule. You're not saying that the Milwaukee County is in dire straits, and regardless of whether these prior statutes give vested interest or not, we've got to go under this other rule that the county needn't comply with it. You're not going under that rule.
I'm not trying to claim that the county would go bankrupt.
Or poverty or dire straits.
I think the county's got dire straits problems, but not of that
level. Well, so do I. So do I, but I have to pay my debts anyway.
I think you're absolutely right.
Okay.
I wanted to defer to my colleague on the remaining arguments, and I thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Levy. And you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Hammond, representing the pension system.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Beth Hannon, here on behalf of the other defendant petitioner, the Milwaukee County Pension Board. The pension board adopts the arguments of the county, which is the employer and the legislative policymaker for the county pension system, but wanted to highlight a few things. First, there's no dispute that the change that's at issue here is prospective only, and Wisconsin public law, the 1945 and then up to 1965, Session Law Chapter 405, which we've discussed somewhat, allow prospective-only changes. By virtue of that 1965 session law, the county has specific home rule authority to make prospective changes. And there's been no argument that the change at issue here to the multiplier is an issue of statewide concern. It is not. It's an issue of local concern, and so it's a proper exercise of the home rule authority of the county.
How does MTI, the case we had when it was released in what, July or August, whatever the date, I thought that it said it was of, that how the local communities fared under their various provisions was a matter of state concern, and the state could regulate it. Maybe you disagree with my brief statement of MTI.
I think there is a distinction to be made, Chief Justice. In that Act 10 case, the court specifically looked at the constitutional home rule authority of the city of Milwaukee, which is a general grant, not a specific grant, which Chapter 405, 1965 is. Specific grant for authority and changes to be made over the Milwaukee County pension system. It's the MTI decision also briefly touched on a statute that gives the city of Milwaukee, or another session law from 1947, home rule authority over the city's pension system. But the issues there was legislation of statewide effect. And here we're only talking about a county ordinance that changes a county pension benefit multiplier. So that I think that's the distinction. The legislation being challenged was broader.
Except that wouldn't the result in this case enable other communities to do the same in their plans?
I don't believe there is any other county over 500,000 members that has this kind of home rule authority over its pension system. So that's the distinction.
Council, you referenced the home rule and the 1965 change, Chapter 405. I want to take a look at some language in 405. And then I want to take a look at the language that precedes it in 1945. Now, just like with your opposing counsel, I used your appendix. I have his appendix in my hand, but I'm questioning you. So whatever page you want to do on your appendix, in the petitioner's appendix, it is on page 87, the 1945, and 88, the 1965. Now, you've referenced the 1965 and emphasized, as did your co-counsel, the part in number one that ends with no changes shall operate to diminish or impair the annuities, benefits, or other rights of any person who is a member of such benefit fund prior to the effective date of any such changes. And prior to the effective date of any such changes, what was just emphasized by your co-counsel at the conclusion of his comments, and you've also referenced it now. I think a reading of this is that whatever rights they had can't be reduced or diminished as a result of these changes. So let's look at what rights they had and when did they vest. And so I go to the page right before, which is 1945, and I'm looking at C. And C of Chapter 138 says Every future entrant who shall become a member of this retirement system after the effective date of this act shall have a similar benefit contract, invested right in annuities, and all other benefits, now I get to the important part, in the amount and on the terms and conditions and in all other respects as provided in the law under which the retirement system was established, as such law shall have been amended, and be in effect at the time of the commencement of his membership. So 1945 ends with, in effect, what you have, your rights, your benefits, that were in effect at the date of commencement of your membership, which I assume to mean when you started work. And so I see this 1965 is saying whatever you had, and you have to look to 45 to see what you had and when it vested, and then that shall not be affected by this change or, I suppose, subsequent changes. So tell me what's wrong with focusing on 1945 language, which ends with you have what you have in effect at the date of the commencement of your membership.
Okay. I think the Court of Appeals in the Federation case, which we talked about in the earlier argument, got it right because it looked at this 1965 provision. And it read at paragraph 14 of that decision that prior to the effective date of such change meant you can't make retroactive changes. And it doesn't mean you can't make any change after a member's first day of employment. And so that's what the Federation Court of Appeals said. It was partly relying on analysis of Loth, and I understand the word vested isn't in Loth, but that was part of the analysis. And I think if we look closely at the 1965 language, what is it talking about? It's talking about who can make a change to the system. And the legislature is handing that over to Milwaukee County. You now can make changes. And then what about or when can you make those changes? You can make changes, but no change shall operate to diminish or impair benefits of a person prior to the effective date of the change. And the Court of Appeals and Federation read that to mean you can't make a retroactive change. It doesn't preclude making a prospective change.
What about the language in 1945, Chapter 138, that indicates that your rights, your benefits are in the amounts, terms, and conditions that existed? Now I'm skipping some words, that existed at the date of the commencement of your membership.
Well, and those terms and conditions include a number of factors, including, is it 6 years, which we know from, I think, the State X Rel Cannon case at one point, it was 6 years to be vested in the retirement, and then it went up to 10 years. And so I think the terms and conditions are important to understanding what benefits a person is eligible for and gains rights in as it is employed by the county.
Why can't I look at, and I don't mean to argue this with you, but I want you to tell me is why I'm wrong, you know, I mean, and that's why I'm asking it this way. But why can't I look at this language in 1945 to say, okay, when the question here is what do you have and when does it vest? Why isn't in effect at the date of commencement of your membership answer the question of when does it vest?
Well, vesting, vesting is a term which this court said is conclusory. And that was in the year 2000 in the Nyman versus American National case, 2000, Wisconsin, 83. So at paragraph 14, the court said, the concept of vested rights is conclusory, which I think means it can't be understood in a vacuum. And the court went on, a right is vested when it has been so far perfected that it cannot be taken away by statute. And this so far perfected aspect of the vesting concept is, have you met all these requirements? Which my co-counsel, Mr. Levy, has discussed the pieces that go into the formula and the other parts of the ordinance that say at what point a person is eligible to retire or they have an amount of retirement benefit accrued and they leave county employment to go somewhere else. It's a deferred benefit. So I think that really gives context to what we've been talking about is vesting and eligibility. They certainly, that's the context in which it's related. And then we get to the most recent act of the legislature when it hands off operation of the system to the county. And that's, the legislature is presumed to know what it said in the past. So what it said in 1937, creating the system, what it said in 1945 about these rights subject to terms and conditions, and then at the point where it says county going forward, and there's no dispute here, we're only talking about going forward prospective changes. You can make changes, but they can't affect rights that existed before the date of the change. They can't be retroactive in effect. I think that's how they read together, primarily under the language of the laws and then going to some case law, which informs us about what this term vesting means. I wanted to talk about one other piece of the statutory chronology. Sorry, Chief.
Your red light's on, so do it in one long sentence, please.
Quickly. I expect that counsel for the plaintiff will talk about 1957 Act, which was first mentioned in the pension board's brief, really just as a means of being complete and capturing the chronology. But as this court said in State ex rel Canon, it was only a restatement of the 1945 provision, and we can take from the shortness of what the State ex rel Canon court said and the fact that the Court of Appeals and Circuit Court in this case didn't even address it, that it really doesn't add anything more, and at the end of the day, the 1965 provision is what the legislature has left us with. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hannon. Mr. Sweetland, you have 30 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The Milwaukee County Employees Retirement System is a defined benefit pension plan. Pension benefit is calculated as a particular percentage of her final average salary multiplied by her years of creditable service. If you have two employees with the same final average salary and the same amount of county service, but one's pension is calculated with a 2% multiplier, but the other's uses a 1.6% multiplier, so the one with the 2% multiplier will get a higher pension benefit. This has already been noted. ERS was created by the legislature in 1937, Chapter 201. Before the legislature turned ERS over to the county's Home Rule Authority in 1965, Chapter 405, it strengthened the employees' pension rights in a series of session laws that amended 201. In particular, 1945, Chapter 138 states that every county employee is deemed to have accepted a benefit contract and vested right in the annuities and all other benefits in ERS, in the amounts and on the terms and conditions and in all other respects as in effect at the date of commencement of her membership. It also says those benefits shall not be diminished or impaired by subsequent legislation or by any other means without her consent. And as counsel just mentioned in her last part of her presentation, 1957, Chapter 326, simply made explicit what was implicit in Chapter 38, simply restated it, and said that Chapter 138 meant that the benefit contract and vested right applied equally to, quote, all increases in benefits covered by amendments subsequent to the date her membership is effective. And then finally, Chapter 405, which gave the county home rule authority over ERS, says that the county could not make any changes to ERS that, quote, operate to diminish or impair the annuities, benefits, or other rights of any person who is a member of such retirement system prior to the effective date of any such change. In other words, the critical date is the date of the change. In this case, we're talking about the ordinance that reduces the multiplier from where it has been immediately, 2.0, to what it now will be, 1.6.
But that was done as part of different contracts, right?
In
contract periods. 2.2 governed one period of contract and 1.6 the other. See, I don't necessarily... Yes, the answer to my question is yes, correct? Yes. Okay.
Yes.
That didn't hurt too much, did it?
Right.
Okay. Now, I don't necessarily hear you saying anything so far contradictory to what your opposing counsel has said. Of course all employees are going to be treated the same. The ones who retire under the contract period at the 2%, I mean, if they tried to distinguish or discriminate against individual employees and say, well, okay, we know you've retired during this period, but we're going to give you a lower multiplier. So it seems to me, well, tell me, is there a property interest in a particular multiplier?
We're not talking about a property interest here. We are talking about a contract right, a provision of a contract, a contract that says you have a vested benefit. And what our position is that your vested right under this contract, you have a vested right to the formula. That is our position.
Not just the formula, but apparently a particular formula.
To the particular formula that is in place immediately before the change that diminishes your benefit. The formula that was in place.
As
the increase in benefit covered by amendments subsequent to the date your membership was in effect, was 2.0.
Counselor, if I agreed with your argument and I was a decision maker for Milwaukee County, I would never, when Milwaukee County was flush with a little money, ever raise the multiplier. Because then if things got tight in Milwaukee County, they could never lower it to match what the income is that they use to pay all this stuff with. Isn't it kind of a contrary argument to what you would hope an employer would do, which is when you got extra money, pay your folks as much as you can, but you're not going to be penalized when you don't have as good an income stream?
If Milwaukee County, as soon as it acquired home rule authority, wanted to say, no, you don't have a vested right to preserve a particular benefit formula with a particular multiplier. When it assumed that home rule authority, it could have said, for future hires, this doesn't apply. You don't have a vested contract that's effective and vested upon your commencement of employment. Section 40.19 of the statutes, which applies to the Wisconsin retirement system, was enacted in 1981. At any point after that, the county could have said, we're going to put the same rule in place for our future hires. In fact, they could have done that when they said people hired after 1981 will only get 1.5%. They could have said, and by the way, their pension will be based on services rendered, but we reserve the right to amend or repeal any of this with respect to future service. They never did that. And now they're coming along and they're saying, but we should be treated as though we did. Because, taking language from one statute and saying, well, it really should be in this ordinance, or this ordinance means the same thing as this statute, which has completely different language. And this statute does not have any language comparable to what's in the prior statutes governing this system. Again, render the language that's in chapters 138, 326, and 405 surplusage, and would also, say that, well, even though these two pieces of legislation have completely different language, we're going to treat them as the same. And, if you take their arguments and say that the county can always change the deal for future service, then that assurance of a vested benefit contract, whether it be for, under the terms in effect at the commencement of your service, whether it be for increased benefits that are made subsequent to the commencement of your employment, if you said that those only apply to services rendered, then those assurances really become worthless, because even before 1945, there was no dispute that you get a benefit based on what you've already done. It was not necessary to add, that you get a benefit, a vested benefit contract immediately upon the commencement of your employment. But if it just meant only for prior service, then the very next day after the employee comes on board, the county could turn around and say, well, that was good for yesterday, but starting tomorrow, we're not going to provide you with that multiplier anymore. Or, yes, under Chapter 326, we'll increase your benefit on Thursday, but on Friday, they turn around and say, but now we're taking that away. What has been vested? Nothing. Nothing. That language about the vested benefit contract in the annuities and benefits under the terms and conditions in effect at the commencement of your employment, and in increased benefits adopted subsequent to become nothing. As I said, the county could long ago have said, wait a minute, back up. This means we want this to operate exactly the same way that the Wisconsin retirement system does, where you get it for services rendered, but not for future service. Interestingly, the first time that they add the word rendered was, I believe, in that 2009 amendment. When you look at the reference on page 48 of the county's appendix, you see that rendered is one of the added terms. So it was only when the county was deciding we're going to retrench the multiplier. We're going to cut the multiplier down from 2.0 to 1.6 for future service. And we're going to have the 2.0 apply only to service previously rendered. Only then did the county decide it's time now to start speaking in the language of Section 40.19.
Counsel, I want to shift your argument over a little bit to another issue that's raised. And did the union agree to this change in multiplier?
This union did.
Okay.
But
and isn't pensions the subject of mandatory collective bargaining at the time the contract was agreed to between the union and the county?
At that time it was.
Right. So I'm just looking at the period of time that we're talking about.
Right.
So the union agreed to it. The employer had to bargain with the union about it. But now I'm hearing, well, yeah, they did have to bargain, but they couldn't make a change unless the individual employees agreed. Well, if the individual employees agreed, I don't see how you end up with a collective bargaining unit that can actually bargain as they're required to on this aspect of employment. Can you explain to me a little bit further than you do in the briefs why they still have the right to object even though the union on their behalf agreed?
Because this court has said in the previous cases, not only in Welter, but in JIK, in the Vallejo versus JI case, in the Dennard versus Waukesha Brewing, I think was the name of it, that where you're dealing with vested rights, vested benefits, you have to get their consents. The union cannot bargain away the vested rights of its members. They have to consent.
When the contract is ratified by the union members, isn't that consent?
But it's got to be ratified by the individual members who are affected.
Didn't the members have a right to vote to ratify this contract?
They did have a right to vote, but there's nothing in here that says that Ms. Stoker ever ratified it, ever voted to ratify it.
Does she deny she had the right? I didn't see that in there. And does she deny that she voted in favor of it? Either one of those. I didn't see anything about that in the stipulation of facts.
No, there's nothing. Nothing in the stipulation of facts addresses those issues. Now, you can say that, okay, for Stoker, her union agreed to this, so Stoker's out of luck. There are still, as I said earlier, I think in the previous argument, this union accounts for a relatively small percentage of the affected county employees. This issue affects more than just the members of this union. There are thousands of county employees who were either non-represented or had been represented by a union that never reached a contract, that never signed a contract agreeing to any of this, and those thousands were subjected to exactly the same thing. Their vested right to a 2% multiplier was reduced for future service.
Counsel,
how
is it that she has a vested right in a multiplier that is prospective? You don't earn that until you have pension service that accrues, and it has to be on or after January 1, 2001, right? So if it establishes a 2% multiplier, and that's applied to all pension service credit earned on and after January 1, 2001, is earning the service a prerequisite to getting that multiplier? And why would she have a vested right in that's prospective?
She also had the 2% applied to all of her service, because part of the 2001 arrangement was that if you continue, your county employment will reach back and give you 8 years, give you the 2% for 8 years back for each year of service that you perform. So that by the end of 2003, she had the 2% for all of her years of service. And we are saying that was the sort of increase, the subsequent increase in benefits that was implicit in Chapter 138 and made explicit in Chapter 326's clarification of 138. Our position is that the vested benefit, that unless you say that the vested, unless you say that the vested benefit contract applies to the formula, including the multiplier, for future service as well as past service, then you really say there's no vested benefit at all other than there's certainly no vested benefit in the terms that were in effect at the time of the commencement of your employment, if the very next day the county could change those terms to future service going forward.
That's right. That's why I'm trying to distinguish what's vested, what's yours, what do you get, versus what's an expectation of what you hope to get if you work these hours and during this time period you get the 2%. Seems to me like it's a future expectation to get 2%. It's not vested because you haven't earned it yet until you put the hours in when that percentage is in place.
It's an assurance that when you do work that service, not just an expectation, but an assurance, and basically a condition preceding, that when you work that service, it will be at 2%. You may not work that. If you don't work the service, you're not going to get the 2%.
Right. So how can you be vested in that percentage?
Because that's what your contract says you will get. You have a contract that is in effect the day you start working. That's
right.
What
but if I quit, I don't get it. So I'm not vested in it. So
And like any other contract, it may have – contracts have conditions preceding. That, if they occur, they trigger the promisor's duty to perform. If they don't perform, the promisor's duty is never triggered. But there was always a contract. that was subject to that condition. And that's what we're saying we have here, that the employee has a contract that says you will be, that if you work, that however many years you work, your service will be, you will get a pension based on this formula, which includes a 2% multiplier.
But could the county change the multiplier, lower the multiplier for new employees?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so let's say this side of the room, they haven't been hired yet.
Mm-hmm.
This side of the room has been hired.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as these people are hired, they could have a 1.6,
mm-hmm.
and they're working right alongside, they're working, continuing to work right alongside people who have a 0.2 multiplier.
That's not uncommon. That is exactly what happened in 1981, when the county said anybody who is hired on or that the multiplier had been 2%. And then the county said in 1981, anyone hired on or after January 1st, 1982, it will be 1.5%. So you had new hires, and they were also going to have to work 10 years to vest, whereas it had been 6 years. And so you had, those who had already been employed having their pensions based on 5-year vesting, or 6-year vesting, I'm sorry, and 2.0. Someone who had been hired on, let's say, December 1st, 1981, had that deal. Someone hired 2 months later on February 1st, 1982, had the lesser deal.
Wasn't that in effect remedied later?
Oh, it was remedied by the 2001 amendment, so that equalized that situation. But no one ever said in 1981, you have to give, I just started now, you have to give me what the other folks had. In fact, employers, a lot of employers have tiered wage systems where existing employees get this level, new employees get this level. Is that good policy? That's the employer's decision. And that really comes down to a policy question.
In the state pension system, mm-hmm. it takes extraordinary votes under the Constitution to increase pension benefits. What's the situation in Milwaukee County?
Well, the county has to, before it can approve any increases, it has to be. Reviewed and recommended by the Pension Study Commission, which is required to get actuarial advice. And I believe it also has to be recommended by the Pension Board. That part I'm not sure, but it certainly has to be approved by the Pension Study Commission. And then it goes to the Finance and Personnel Committee of the County Board. Then the County Board has to pass it as an ordinance, and it's subject, again, to...
But it's just an ordinary majority vote?
The County Board, yes. Yes. And one of the issues that surrounded the 2001 increases was the quality of the actuarial advice that was given to both the Pension Study Committee and the and the financial person.
As I understand it, there's no evidence that Suzanne Stoker consented to the change in the formula.
Correct.
Is that right?
Correct.
But the collective bargaining agreement was ratified by the membership.
But the...
And this is a class action?
No, it's... This was... Well, I mean, this... One of the plaintiffs here is the Wisconsin Federation of Nurses. So, to that extent, it does apply to this particular union. However, and as I just said, it does not apply to anybody outside this union. But these changes were imposed unilaterally on everybody else. They were imposed unilaterally on the non-reps. They were imposed unilaterally on the employees who had been represented by AFSCME. And those two groups constitute by far the largest number of county employees.
So unilaterally, you're not using unilaterally the way Loeff used unilaterally. You're not using the word unilaterally the way Loeff used the word unilaterally.
Right. I'm saying it in the context of there was no bargaining, no collective bargaining.
The county just imposed it on the others.
Correct.
I just didn't want confusion on that.
Right. So.
Explain again about this 8 years. Does the 2% in any way affect service prior to the enactment of the 2%? Does it affect benefits for services rendered before the 2% was put into effect?
Yes. Yes, it does. Because the 2001 amendment said that if you're already here and you've worked here, well, in Ms. Stoker's case, you've worked here for 19 years at 1.5. If you continue working, not only will that future service be at 2%, but we will apply the 2% multiplier to 8 years of prior service for every year of future service that you work. So with 19 years, that meant that she had to work 2 years, you know, so after 1 year, she got 8 years back at 2%. After 2 years, she had 16 years back at 2%. And by sometime in the middle of 2003, all 19 of her years were
so when it was 2%. Reduced to less than 2%, what effect did that have on all these prior years?
It didn't change the prior years.
Okay. Just went from then on.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Red light is on, counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Levy.
A couple of points of rebuttal, if I may.
Could you bring the microphone?
Yes.
There we go.
It seems to travel on me. I'm sorry. The question of this 1957 version of the session laws raises an interesting pair of points, if I may. One is that, for whatever reason, the language about future changes is not repeated in the 1965 version, which I take to mean that on further consideration, the legislature decided they didn't want to use that version. When they granted home rule, they did not continue it. They went back to a version closer to what they had in 1945. So I don't think, I think there's a problem depending on that argument to begin with, because it was never considered below. But besides that, I don't think the legislature intended to retain that future change kind of guarantee. The other thing that this raises is that the lower court cases talk about Welter and Rehrauer. And I think it's helpful to note that on paragraph 16 of the Rehrauer decision, the court says that the Milwaukee City Charter specified a vested right in the benefits, and if I can skip a couple of words, in effect at the date of commencement of his or her membership and as subsequently amended. So in other words, the city charter talked about not only preserving whatever was there the day of the movement to a city plan, but further, anything subsequently amended. There is no language like that in the county's ordinance.
Where do you find that in the city charter? The city charter is chapter 36, and in 36.13.2c, it says, in effect, at the date of the commencement of his membership, and I don't see the rest of that language, so where do you get that
from? I'm quoting from paragraph 16 because I didn't bring the language of the charter with me, but the court there says that 36.13.2c of the city charter says they have a vested right in the benefits, in the amounts, and on the terms and conditions, and in all other respects as provided in law, in effect at the date of the commencement of his or her membership. This is the individual becoming employed. Mm-hmm. And then it goes on to say, and as subsequently amended.
Does that attribute the and as subsequently amended as part of 36.13.2c, or is coming from some other source?
I'm just reading the quotation in the decision, and it's within the quotes in the decision.
Because we have the same reference in our recent MTI decision, and it doesn't have that extra language. It just ends at the date of the commencement of this membership.
So. This is a 2001 decision, and that may explain a difference. I don't know.
Yeah, it's also italicized in the decision, so must have been important to the writers of the Court of Appeals decision. I mean, I'm just looking at my copy of the rarest.
And I'm simply saying it's another example of how important it is to look at the exact language.
That's
and
right.
To look at the fact that in 1965 there was no attempt to preserve that subsequently amended idea in the transfer from home rule. The other point I would like to make is just this. In Champaign and the other cases about sick pay, there is this discussion about how you can make prospective changes as long as you preserve what has been earned up until that point. And we think that that is exactly what's happening here in the change in the multiplier. No change in anything that affected the benefit up until the effective date of the change. The effective date of the change in multiplier is purely prospective, and that's as permissible here as it was in Champaign, Pasco, Forth, and all the other cases about unilateral contracts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Levy. On behalf of the court, I want to thank Mr. Levy and Mr. Friedman for their arguments in this case and in the prior case, and we thank Ms. Hammond for coming in on this case representing the pension board again in trying to distinguish among the cases and the concepts of vested interests and property rights and prospective versus retroactive changes in benefits. So you leave the court with making the decision here in 2012 AP 2466 Stoker versus Milwaukee County, but we thank you for your assistance in both cases. It's 12:35. The court will be in recess until 1:30, when it will hear the third case, which has nothing to do with the facts or law related to your case.